Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Human Services Finance Committee meeting. I call this meeting to order. Members, we have a quorum present. I will begin with the approval for minutes. Vice Chair Burner, you want to approve the minutes for March 23, 2023?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved. I move the minutes for March 23, 2023.
Vice Chair Burner moves the approval for minutes for March 23, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails. The minutes for March 23, 2023 are now approved. Members, we have a historic bill before us today. This is a historic investment in long-term care, historic investment in disability community, historic investment to address the opioid epidemic. I don't want to take much of the time. We'll have more time to discuss on Thursday. We will dive into straight into the testimony from those who have read. But before I do that, we will go through the nonpartisan stuff. We'll start with the House Fiscal, Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair and members, Dorian, you should have in your packet a spreadsheet that looks like this on legal size paper. It is labeled mistakenly in the top left House Human Services Committee House File 2843. It should say 2847, as it does in the other corner. And then at the bottom it should be the 327-11-24 a.m. edition. To do a very abbreviated walkthrough, as has been requested, to look at line 7, which, if you go over to the House columns, which are shaded, you will see in the 24-25 column that this bill spends $1.3 billion above base, which is our target, and then in the tails, $1,550,000,000 above base. That is the bill matches our target at this point. And I'm only going to highlight four substantial items that really characterize the main effect of this bill. If you turn to page 4 of the spreadsheet, the top two items on lines 189 and 195, they are the modifications to the DWRS inflation adjustments. And the on line 195, they are the effects of the Community First Service and Supports Rate Framework, which is the SEIU contract plus money for PCAs is in there now, additional money for PCAs. And then if you go to the next page, page 5, you have on line 231 other HCBS increases. These are increases to rates for things like alternative care and home duty nursing, ECS. And then the one below that on line 241 is the elderly waiver increase. Those four items spend $2,125,000,000 of the total new spend, and that's kind of the focus of this bill, is to increase rates in those services, to increase pay for workers in those services. So with that, I'll stop there and let House Research go.
We move to the House Research. Ms. Pena.
Mr. Chair and members, Ms. Sunderman and I will be working off of the document that you all should have had in your packets that is titled House File 2847H2847DE1, list of bills included. The first article is Article 1, Disability Services. The first grouping of sections, starting with Section 1.
Where?
10 through 12, 22, 24 through 26, 40, 41, and 50 through 52 includes the governor's proposal to phase out subminimum wages for people with disabilities. Sections 2, 37 through 39, 47, and 48 includes the governor's proposal related to the SEIU contract for self-directed services workforce. Section 3 is the governor's proposal related to positive support provider training. Section 4 is a section that modifies the adult foster care moratorium exceptions. Section 5 is a governor's proposal related to home and community-based services corporate license application fees. It aligns DHS fees with similar fees that the Minnesota Department of Health collects for licensing similar services. Sections 6, 7, and 9 modifies alternate overnight supervision requirements for community residential settings. Sections 8, 27, 29 through 31, 34, 35, and 59 are the governor's proposal related to establishing a life sharing benefit and family residential rate tiers. Sections 13, 42, and 44 relate to the governor's proposal establishing capacity and workforce expansion programs. Section 14 requires the Council on Disability to provide an annual report regarding local government website accessibility training. Sections 15 and 16 are the governor's proposal related to MAEPD program improvements and conforming changes. Sections 17 to 20 relate to the PCA program and allow for PCAs to drive clients. Sections 21 and 57 are the governor's proposal related to improving the assessment experience for people and lead agencies. Sections 23 and 45 are the governor's proposal providing for an EIDBI culturally responsive rate and licensure study. Sections 28, 30, 32, 33, and 36 are the governor's proposal providing for database rates for residential and own home disability services. Section 43 establishes home and community-based services workforce incentive fund grants. Section 46 is the governor's proposal related to planning for innovative and community-driven workforce solutions. Section 49 is the governor's proposal related to investing in technology to support independent living and address home and community-based services workforce challenges. Sections 53 to 56 provide for payment rate increases for a variety of disability services. And section 58 is a modification of a governor's proposal. It provides for an acute care hospitalization decompression study. And that concludes Article 1. If there aren't any questions, we can move on to Article 2, which is aging services, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed. Thanks.
Section 1 modifies the Board on Aging Native American Elders Coordinator position. Sections 2, 4, and 18 modify the Live Well at Home grants. Sections 3 and 14 establish caregiver respite services grants. Section 5 is a governor's proposal. It relates to the Vulnerable Adult Act redesign. This is phase 2 of that. Section 6 relates to a governor's proposal. It modifies nursing facility case mix classifications. Sections 7 and 8 are also a governor's proposal. It provides for designating critical access nursing facilities. Sections 9 to 11 and 19 modify the elderly waiver payment rate methodology. Sections 12 and 13 are a governor's proposal related to capacity and workforce expansion programs. This expands or extends, I should say, the Age-Friendly Minnesota Council and extends the grants related to that. Section 15 provides for PACE implementation funding. Section 16 provides rate increases for certain home and community-based services. Section 17 is a governor's proposal supporting transitions for small customized living providers, and that concludes Article 2.
We move to Article 3. Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair and members, Sarah Sunderman from House Research. I'll be going through the remainder of the articles. Article 3 is behavioral health. Sections 1 and 2 are a governor's proposal establishing the Office of Addiction and Recovery. These also incorporates aspects of House Bill 2772, so incorporating some language about youth substance use. Sections 3 through 5 are governor's proposal related to the overall governor's proposal of improving quality of substance use disorder treatment and addressing administrative burdens. These sections add definitions in Chapter 245G and update a cross-reference. Sections 6 and 7 are governor's proposals relating to improving SUD treatment quality. These extend the timeline to complete a comprehensive assessment and modify comprehensive assessment requirements. Sections 8 and 9 similarly extend the timeline to complete individual treatment plans and modify individual treatment plan requirements. Sections 10 and 11 are governor's proposals related to SUD treatment quality and administrative burdens. These modify the treatment plan review requirements for providers and the frequency of the reviews depending on the level of care provided. Section 12 is just a cross-reference update. Section 13 was mistakenly included. It relates to peer recovery supports and a cross-reference, but we are not doing that whole package. Section 14 is a governor's proposal. This removes the assessment summary from the required client records content. Section 15 relates to the governor's proposal for MA-SUD treatment continuum transformation. This modifies non-medication treatment documentation requirements for opioid treatment programs. Section 16 is the governor's proposal. This allows alcohol and drug counselors to document certain information in a diagnostic assessment. Section 17, this is a governor's proposal. These are changes to the 48-hour rule. This allows the commissioner to triage people to admit to state-operated treatment programs and also specifies that the requirement for priority admission to state-operated programs within 48 hours begins at the point at which a medically appropriate bed is available. Sections 18, 19, and 21 are all governor's proposals related to SUD treatment quality and administrative burdens. These add definitions to Chapter 254B. Section 20 is the governor's proposal related to sober housing program regulation and consumer protections. It adds a definition of sober home. Section 22, this adds the ASAM, so the American Society of Addiction Medicine standards and levels of care for SUD treatment rate requirements. Section 23 is a governor's proposal. These are withdrawal management, startup, and capacity building grants. Section 24 is the governor's proposal. This establishes a registry of certified sober homes and outlines certification requirements for sober homes. Section 25, this codifies the ASM level standards of care for SUD treatment and lists the vendor requirements and requirements for patient referral arrangements, evidence-based practices, and program outreach plans. Section 26, this is evidence-based training for SUD treatment providers and supports to support the transition to these ASM standards that are now codified. Section 27 is the governor's proposal. This requires non-residential substance use disorder treatment programs to enroll in the federal demonstration project by January 1st, 2025. Sections 28 through 30 are related to the governor's proposals on the opioid epidemic. These are family treatment, startup and capacity building grants, safe recovery sites, startup and capacity building grants, and a public awareness campaign. Section 31 is also related to the governor's proposals on the opioid epidemic. This requires the commissioner to revise payment methodology for SUD services with medications for opioid use disorder. Section 32 is a governor's proposal. This is an evaluation of MA coverage for traditional healing, behavioral health services in correctional facilities, and contingency management. And Section 33 is just a reviser instruction, and Section 34 is a repealer. And this is a repealer related to treatment plan contents, which are moved earlier in the bill. And the SUD demonstration project rate for medium intensity residential programs. And this also repeals provisions governing the transfer of funds received by SUD facilities operated by state operated regional treatment center or nursing home. And that concludes Article 3. Moving to Article 4, this is the opioid response prevention, opioid overdose prevention and opioid epidemic response article. These are, I believe, all governor's proposals. Section 1 modifies the requirements for deposits of opioid settlement funds by removing references to a specific statutory section. I believe this is the section that corrects the drafting error. Section 2 requires school districts or charter schools to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists. Section 3 deletes a provision related to a portion of reduced opioid registration fees to be deposited into the opiate epidemic response fund. That's related to a later change in the bill. Sections 4 through 6, these are corrections provisions, and they add that opioid overdose emergency procedures. There has to be guidance on those in the minimum standards issued by the Commissioner of Corrections. It requires community correction programs to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists and requires the provision of emergency opiate antagonist rescue kits upon an individual's release if the individual has a history of opioid use disorder. Section 7 requires licensed SUD providers to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists. Section 8, this is the governor's proposal on reducing disparities and addressing the opioid epidemic. This adds members to the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council for each Minnesota tribal nation and two members from urban Indian communities. Section 9 is part of the same governor's proposal. This requires at least 50% of ORAT grants to be awarded for projects focused on Black and Indigenous communities and communities of color. Sections 10 and 11, these modify appropriations from the registration and licensing fee account by adding appropriations for opiate antagonist distribution, traditional healing, and for administrative costs. And this also makes appropriations from this account and the settlement account available for up to 3 years. Section 12 requires site-based or group housing support settings to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists. Section 13 deletes some language about the opiate epidemic response fund's base in session law. Section 14 establishes the opioid overdose surge text message alert system. Section 15 establishes harm reduction and culturally specific grants. Section 16 repeals the opioid registration fee sunset and provision regarding reduction of the fee. And I believe that concludes Article 4. Moving to Article 5, this article is six sections, and it is the governor's proposal related to, or for the opioid prescribing improvement program modifications. It modifies the, by adding an additional purpose, modifies the definitions, and removes references to opioid disenrollment standards. It also requires the DHS quality improvement program to be designed to support patient-centered care and to discourage unsafe tapering practices and patient abandonment. And it also modifies the quality improvement plan provider requirements. It also requires the commissioner to dismiss a prescriber from participating in the opioid prescribing improvement program when the prescriber demonstrates that the their practices are patient-centered and reflect community standards. And it allows the commissioner to investigate providers whose prescribing practices fall within the sanctioned standards, and this is instead of terminating or disenrolling providers. It also establishes in Section 5 sanction standards for providers enrolled in medical assistance and lists sanctionable practices relating to opioid prescribing or discontinuation. And in Section 6 allows the commissioner to impose sanctions against a vendor for violating standards defined by the opioid prescribing work group. That concludes Article 5. Finally, moving to Article 6, this is this article establishes the new Department of Direct Care and Treatment. So it separates state-operated direct care and treatment services from the Department of Human Services and sets up the new department. It specifies executive board requirements, and the executive board will lead the new department. It also outlines requirements for transferring duties to the new department and authority to the new department and employees, and provides for employee protections. And that concludes the overview of the bill. Article 7 of the bill is the appropriations article, which is reflected on the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Thank you to Ms. Tignelli and also Mr. Beck. Any technical questions, members, because we will have 4 hours of discussion on Thursday. Just wanted to know that. Seeing none, we'll start with the testifiers. Ms. Nelson, followed by Sue Hankner, and then we'll go to Jean Finney and also Leo Finney. If you can come close by, please introduce yourself for the record. And
good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. I am Jillian Nelson with the Autism Society of Minnesota. After a late night of reading through the DEE amendment, I wanted to take an opportunity to thank you for a bill that clearly considers the health and well-being of the disability community. I would first like to thank you enthusiastically for including the provisions for increasing wages for people with disabilities through the elimination of Section 14C. You are on the right side of history in this choice. And alongside the correction of this human rights violation, this is a wise economic choice for our state and a much needed boost to our workforce. I would also like to thank you for moving forward with addressing the home and community-based care crisis and supporting care staff in all arenas. I am thrilled to see the EIDBI licensure study and the important move to focus on the safety of the autism community and our youngest members. And lastly, my gratitude for making adjustments to the PCAs to allow PCAs to drive clients without waiting for future care models to roll out. Your dedication and commitment to our community did not go unnoticed, and we are endlessly thankful for your work. We do hope to have further discussions throughout conference committee regarding MAAPD, as well as the accessibility of disability services. Again, thank you for all your time today and for all of your hard work this session.
Thank you so much. Ms. Hankner.
Chair Noor, members of the Human Services Finance Committee, I am, for the record, I'm Sue Hankner, representing A-Team Minnesota. Our network of A-Team Minnesota families with a member who is unable or has limited ability to speak and advocate for themselves want to thank you for your efforts to reinforce supports our family members need for their daily lives. We are, of course, disappointed to see language related to eliminating the subminimum or special wage work option that we oppose. Through your work, you identified a workforce shortage of people who support our family members 24/7, the direct support professionals. No home, work, or life enrichment disability services can be safe or feasible for them without direct support professionals. Elimination of subminimum wage will likely require an increased workforce of direct support professionals. No one can calculate those costs for today nor the future. Center-based special wage work options are the informed choice of our family members. As parents, siblings, aunts, uncles, and grandparents of people with moderate to profound intellectual or developmental disability, we ask that you engage in fact-finding to learn about provider business models using subminimum wage option. Identify strengths and weaknesses. Who is served? Are they doing what they want? Why is it their choice? And identify improvements. We ask you to please honor the informed choice of our family members who have significant intellectual or developmental disabilities. Thank you for giving us time to share our thoughts with you today.
Thank you so much. Next is Leo and also Jean Feeney. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourselves for the record and proceed.
Alongside the road to Duluth, the MSO.
Introduce.
Oh, excuse me.
No problem.
I'm Jean Feeney, and alongside the road to Duluth, the MSOP facility is hidden by forests. Equally hidden is the imprisonment of hundreds of men at the facility, men no longer flawed, not a threat to their community, men who belong back in the community where they can contribute to society. The documented record confirms MSOP has constructed the men's progress home, obstructed the men's progress home by the use of manipulated and dishonest delay tactics. These tactics verify the men's fear. They are on death row and will never return home. Recently, I had a personal contact with Dr. James Poole, who is a frail 85-year-old resident who has been incarcerated at Moose Lake for many years. I heard his story. July 14, 2022, Dr. Poole was taken by ambulance from Moose Lake to Duluth, where he had open-heart surgery. 10 days later, Dr. Poole was transported to a nursing home in St. Peter. In his weakened condition, he was shackled in leg chains and the feet, a waist chain, handcuffed so tightly that paralysis resulted in both hands. Today, he continues to have loss of dexterity of his right hand. Moose Lake, he was then transported back to Moose Lake, placed in solitary confinement. The Resident Advisory Family Council at Moose Lake has for its goal to develop policies to improve MSOP. MSOP's staff and administration have mainly obstructed any efforts for change at MSOP. For example, the RAFC suggested there be chairs placed in public areas at MSOP where clients wait for a visit to health services and other matters. Currently, clients are required to sit on the floor. The men remain on the floor. The RFAC board proposed a clients helping clients program be instituted. Clients would assist other clients requesting written medical assistance and help with legal and personal matters. This program has encouraged bonding and socialization. This program was shut down last week. To quote an incarcerated poet at Moose Lake, "This institution has sucked the life from my shattered bones. I have been broken. I am so angry I could cry. The unnecessarily cruel and unusual tortures inflicted by MSOP make my gray matter spin and hope collapse like a black hole." Respectfully submitted, Jean Feeney, mother of Matthew Feeney, incarcerated at Moose Lake.
Thank you, Ms. Feeney. Mr. Feeney, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dan Wilson's story, last Thursday, March 23rd, Dan Wilson, incarcerated at MSOP Moose Lake and unable to be here and speak, composed a one-page letter addressed clearly to the legislature. That letter will never be received by the legislature because it was confiscated by MSOP. I was present at MSOP when Dan Wilson disclosed his story to the men last Saturday. They had no reaction. I asked why. Their response, because it happens here all the time. I was also present on Saturday when a survey of 13 of the 750-minute MSOP was taken. The total time for this bunch served was 133 years. The average time for each prisoner, 10-plus years and climbing. These times will increase as releases are few, delays ongoing, and death the only surest exit for these men. On June 21st, 2015, D.J. Tice cited Judge Donovan Frank's call on the legislature for reform. D.J. Tice noted, as Frank noted, that state officials have long known that there was something very wrong at MSOP, but year after year, the legislature failed to act. Virtually every leading political figure in Minnesota over the past quarter century has contributed. Courts, both state and federal, have also gone along. Political opportunists have pounced cynically, demonizing any efforts at slowing commitments or accelerating the journey home. Excuse me. This is where Dan Wilson lives, where the program pretends to be, and its betrayal. Today, MSOP is an unexploded scandal that sweeps in too many that don't belong there. Conclusion: Minnesota politicians have constructed at MSOP a prison worthy of a third world dictatorship. The betrayal continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finn, for your testimony. Next is Ms. Thalo and Ms. Cullen, if you can come to the testify table, and then we'll forward by Mr. Ackett. Please introduce yourself to the record and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative as well. Leading Age Minnesota is an organization that represents the continuum of senior care. And core to our mission and vision is that seniors should have access to care options in their home communities. As I look at the proposal before us today, I see a piecemeal approach to this vision and one that threatens the core of our senior care infrastructure. With a historic budget surplus, and a growing senior population, we can and must do better for our seniors. Our members at Leading Age Minnesota provide community-based care like assisted living, adult day services, or home care under the Elderly Waiver Program very much appreciate the inclusion of elderly waiver funding in the bill. For years, we have advocated for an infusion into this program, and we want to thank you for recognizing the insufficient funding of this program. We are also appreciative of the inclusion of PACE, the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a frog in my throat. More than 30 other states have already implemented PACE, and we are glad that Minnesota is taking the step on this journey, as it represents a step towards addressing health disparities in long-term care, as well as providing prevention strategies for addressing hospital compression issues. However, I would be remiss if I didn't express my disappointment for the lack of funding for nursing homes in this bill. And I know my colleague, Ms. Cullen, will address this in greater detail. We can and must do better. We have talked at length about the crisis in nursing homes, and we feel that it has fallen on deaf ears. And we look forward to working with you to address this omission from the bill.
Ms. Scott, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, Patty Cullen, President, CEO of Care Providers of Minnesota, and also half of the Long-Term Care Imperative. As a membership association, one of my jobs is to advocate for members, but to also listen to members. So most of my comments are going to be surrounding the nursing facility funding or lack thereof in this bill. But I did want to start out acknowledging the breath of relief that my assisted living members had when they saw the elderly waiver program funded at the level where we all recommended that it get to that threshold years ago, and it was a slow and steady, but not so steady, increase. So thank you for that. This bill, though, is confusing at best because there's an assumption, I think, built in that nursing homes in Minnesota are going to be all right because there's a forecasted number. And because there's a small, and I will say very unworkable, critical access nursing facility program built in. It's a false assumption. As an association representing nursing homes, I receive weekly calls from members who don't have cash to pay back the banks, who want to know who they call at what agency to get the closure plan information or to try to get an advance so they can make payroll. Their greatest hope for survival was the financial investment pending before this committee found in House File 733, which was not included in this final bill. So now my response will be, do you have enough time to planfully close? Should you call the Department of Health to ask for them to take the keys? Or should you close without the notice required in statute? The most recent call I got came from a community nursing home. They're the only ones in the county. They're the only ones within 100 miles. And those seniors will be displaced far from home.
Unbelievable.
Most of our nursing home members spent their reserves. They borrowed from their local banks when the legislature failed to provide them with the needed relief at the end of the 2022 session. They've spent beyond their rates because they had to keep their workforce. They've been deficit spending but believed the legislature and governor would act quickly to address their crisis before more closures lead to even more dramatic access issues. I don't know what to tell them now. Minnesota was one of very few states that did not give direct funding to nursing homes during COVID to pay for PPE, to pay for the temporary staff, to pay for the vaccinations, to pay for the screenings. That lack of financial assistance has now come to fruition with facility closures, bed closures, denied admissions, and no ability to bridge to the future. We understand there's tough spending choices. We just don't understand how no relief can be provided to our nursing homes at a time when we've never needed it more. If you think nursing homes are going to be okay because there's a forecasted number, remember, forecasted increases reflect past payments, not current or future needed funds. The forecast is projected growth based on past expenditures, not an infusion of money to keep our doors open or to give our workforce a raise so that they'll stay in our communities. Forecasts also assume occupancy at levels we don't have right now. We're not being paid for empty beds. Let me remind you, we're living with the virus in our setting still. This virus decimated our workforce, our reserves, and the spirit of many of our caregivers. And it's difficult to understand with this surplus why we're forgotten.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Ms. Sack, and also Wayne Baca, if you can come to the table. Danny. And also, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danny Acker. I serve as the director of State Government Relations for the Minnesota Hospital Association. MHA supports House File 2847, Article 1, Section 46, which directs the Commissioner of Human Services to conduct a study on options to expand access to non-acute services for people with co-occurring behavioral health conditions and disabilities. The study directs the Commissioner to evaluate strategies to decrease the number of people who remain in hospitals, jails, and other acute or crisis settings that no longer meet medical or other necessary criteria. MHA also supports House File 2847, Article 1, Section 58, which directs the Commissioner to conduct a hospital decompression study and a systemic review to analyze and develop recommendations for methods to increase and enhance statewide provider capacity to support people with complex needs. We urge this committee to consider amending these studies to include specific and additional attention for children and adolescent patients boarding in acute care settings. We fear that without an explicit requirement for studying children in this context, the results will not produce enough information or analysis to significantly raise our collective awareness of the unique issues they face and the unique solutions that must be pursued. We cannot wait two more years to still not know what we don't know. The proposed studies above will allow the legislature to better understand the root causes for the discharge backlog and develop long-term policy solutions. However, it will not provide immediate assistance. As such, we are disappointed that the governor's budget proposal for an acute care transition temporary payment program was not included. This temporary program is aimed at addressing barriers for complex, high-acuity need patients transitioning from acute care settings to services provided in the community and long-term care services supports. We view this temporary program as an important incentive necessary to help community and long-term care providers admit more complex patients and help our most acute patients get to the best care setting at the right time specific to their needs. In closing, MHA appreciates the committee's recognition of the serious problem of hospital boarding and its effect on patient care, and we are standing ready to assist in any way we can. We encourage the committee and the legislature to consider more short-term and immediate solutions to bolster the care continuum as this bill moves forward in the process.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For your testimony, the next person I have Sarah Driver. Actually, John Burke, and will be followed by Sarah and Dave Brennan. Please introduce yourself for the record and continue
the testimony. Chair Nor and committee members, my name is John Wayne Barker, and I'm the executive director of Merrick Inc., a day program that offers a full array of service options to meet the informed choice of 400 adults with disabilities. And before I introduce Bill, Representative Quam, last week you asked a special minimum wage question, and a person who's not an expert on 14C jumped to the microphone and really didn't answer your question. Uh-huh. To answer your question, I know some day programs have clients that are artists that do not get paid while making their artwork and only get paid if it sells. And that selling price may not translate into a minimum wage for the hours that it took them to make that artwork. It is possible that this legislation would eliminate that option that's available to non-disabled citizens. And if I'm not certain about that, then they're certainly not certain about that. So it is a possibility, to answer your question. So with me today is Bill Guggenberg. Do you want to say hi?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
Bill, this is a committee of legislators. They're our friends. They make laws in the state of Minnesota, and they're here to learn a little bit about you. And your representative is right there, Representative Peter Fisher. He just waved his hand at you, okay? Merrick funds a full-time self-advocacy position, and a group of self-advocates chose to attend Disability Day at the Capitol this afternoon, so I made last-minute arrangements for Bill to join me at this hearing. Bill is one of our more capable workers earning a special minimum wage, and I'm going to ask him a few questions so that the committee members have a real example of our workforce. This is unscripted, unplanned. I'm curious to see how this goes, so I'm going to ask him some questions, and we'll see what Bill has to say. Bill, do you live on your own or in a group home?
In a group home.
Do you know the address of your home?
2214 North St. Paul East, Minnesota, 55109.
Okay. And do you like your home?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you ride Metro Mobility or the city bus to get to work?
New Tracks.
So New Tracks is a private transportation provider that gets you to and from your places. Is there someone that always drives you to and from wherever you go?
Yes.
Is there a reason why you don't use Metro Mobility or the city bus?
Because New Tracks help me get place to place.
Okay. The reason, as noted in his paperwork, is that Bill could not have any alone time in the community for his own health and safety purposes, and so he has to be supported and driven to and from any place in his community. Bill, where do you work?
At Merrick.
Do you know the address of your work?
No.
What do you do when you're at work?
I shred paper, shred pull tabs, and prep them, and shred cardboard and put cardboard in.
And do you like the people you work with?
Yeah.
And do you like the work that you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Good to hear. Bill, how do you spend your money?
I spend my money when I go out to eat on places with my staff.
Okay, so going out in the community to eat, do you go shopping?
I go shopping too, yeah.
Okay. What have you done for fun this month?
Gone out to eat.
Yeah, where'd you go?
Different places, Dairy Queen and all that kind of stuff.
Dairy Queen? Is that one of your favorite go-tos?
Yeah.
Okay. Bill, have you taken a vacation? Vacation?
Not for a while.
What was the last vacation you took?
I don't remember.
Did you go to Disney World?
Yeah, I've been to Lando and stuff, yeah.
Okay, Wisconsin Dells?
Something like that, but I might go camping this summer. I don't know yet.
Okay, you hope to go camping. Okay, so hopefully it's clear that Bill has a good basic quality of life. With all of his living expenses and medical care covered by Medicaid, and certainly not a life of poverty as alleged by the proponents of this legislation. And changing his wage will not do anything to change his quality of life, because his SSI and SSDI benefit will be offset nearly dollar for dollar by any increase in wage. And in my written testimony that I will give to the committee on Thursday, I'll reveal kind of what the sneaky, heartless plan is here behind this legislation. In closing comments last week, Ms. Nelson stated, and I quote, "This impacts my work as a human being." Well, this is not about her. It's about Bill. It's about 200 clients at Merrick and nearly 6,000 people and their families statewide that have made an informed choice to earn a special minimum wage. Their choices should prevail, and the committee's delete everything addendum should delete any language that eliminates and tracks 14C wages. Thank you for allowing Bill and I to testify.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Mr. Becker, for your testimony. We move to the next testifiers, Sarah. Driver, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. We'll be followed by Dave. Dave Brent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Driver, and I'm actually here simply as a parent. I want to be able to thank you personally for your efforts around EIDBI access and provider supports and tell you a little bit about my experience and why I'm so thankful. My partner Aang and I are proud parents of twin boys, Ari and Archer. Our kids just turned 3 on February 19th. And to say it has been a roller coaster having given birth and raised special needs twins during COVID is an understatement. After a difficult pregnancy and 2 months of hospital bed rest, I gave birth at 26 weeks and my partner could not be present. My boys spent 111 and 117 days in the NICU. Navigating services from the moment they were born was difficult, but I'm privileged. I'm educated and an experienced advocate. Not everybody is. Before transitioning home, I made sure to apply for disability and got my kids SMRTed and on Medicaid. I grew up with an autistic sibling and recognized telltale signs as early as 12 months. One of my boys skipped crawling and failed to make eye contact or follow or track objects, and the other did not respond to stimuli or his name and yet passed hearing exams. And by 18 months, neither child verbally identified mom or dad, and they were frequently inconsolable. Archer could not handle transitions and had an extensive oral aversion, and he was deemed failure to thrive and placed on a G-tube. Ari did not engage with his brother, parents, or other people and frequently rocked and flapped his hands near his face. We sought a diagnosis as soon as clinically recommended and possible at 18 months, and we waited almost a year for an assessment by a CMDE evaluator. I did everything I could and went down the list of providers on the Help Me Connect site. And even after our assessment, when we were ready for therapy, I could not find anyone who would provide services for us for ABA therapy or for EIDBI services without an extensive wait list. And some wouldn't even put me on a wait list because it was so long they had frozen it and stopped taking new people. My children just qualified for special education preschool in February. And they have still not had the benefit of therapy for their spectrum disorders. Ari has a diagnosis of level 3 autism, and he is semi-verbal in that he repeats some words or phrases but cannot ask for things or tell me his needs or his feelings. And he has begun to self-harm. He hits his head and pulls his hair and remains withdrawn. He doesn't play with other children, including his twin brother. Archer is more functional but has more physical needs. He cannot handle stairs, which are not a problem now because I can carry him, but they will be a problem soon. Our preschool has brought up that the challenging behaviors may make it so that school is not the best place for my children. And we have no other options. At 3 years, they've spent the majority of their lives on wait lists. But you have given us hope. Not just my children, but 2,000 other families who are lingering on wait lists now have hope. In closing, I want to share that I told my kids about the opportunity to speak to you today, and I hope that someday they will understand the importance of advocating for others and know how much their parents love and support them. And in response, Archer assured me that this would go well, and you would support these bills because lalligators, which is legislators, are an gao kiet, which is Vietnamese for like heroes, like Spider-Man and the police. And heroes always help the people. So as one advocate to another, and as one parent to all of you, thank you so much for being the heroes that my children and so many other children across our state truly need. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Dave will be followed by Andre Best and also Carrie Johnson, if you can get close by. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dave Renner. I'm here representing the Minnesota Medical Association, also speaking for the Minnesota Society of Interventional Pain Physicians, who are the physicians who really treat patients with chronic pain. Specifically talking about Article 5 in the DE1 Amendment, and this is dealing with the Opioid Improvement Program. Many of the changes that are suggested in this article are improvements to the program. However, it goes further also to start establishing sanctions that potentially can happen for physicians who potentially are prescribing what DHS believes is beyond the standard of care. The Opioid Improvement Program was established back when we had a significant opioid prescribing problem, and we acknowledge that. We have been working with Department of Human Services. We've been working on our own through the Medical Association to educate prescribers and change behavior, and we're glad to say that we have seen a significant reduction in prescription of opioids. The concern we have with Article 5 and the sanctions is that it is having a chilling effect on prescribers willing to treat patients with chronic pain. You've heard from many of these constituents who are having a hard time finding physicians. And we question whether it really is appropriate for the Department of Human Services to be establishing standards of care and then putting sanctions on prescribers based on those standards. What they're using for these standards are guidelines, and we think that they're being used inappropriately. So we would encourage question about whether the course of this program has run its course and whether it's time for this opioid improvement program to be sunset. Appreciate to have you take any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Beth, Andrew Beth. Followed by Kerry Johnson, if you are here. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andre Best. I'm the vice chair for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. We're a statewide membership association for personal care assistant providers. I'm also the CEO at Best Care, a PCA waivered and FMS service provider. We appreciate the work being done and the ongoing dialogue about the PCA reimbursement rate. and the importance of getting it right for the most diverse program. The Provider Alliance only cautions policymakers that passing significant wage and benefit increases without adequate increases in the reimbursement rate puts the PCA program at risk. This is especially true for the smaller providers who are BIPOC owned and largely serving their own communities. Less diversity in our provider pool, as you can guess, will limit the ability of recipients to receive care from people from their communities who look like them. So we desperately ask that you amend and increase the implementation factor to 94.75 in order to adequately fund the wage and benefit increases. This continued investment is essential to support the efforts of providers and the 44 individuals receiving services to recruit and retain workers. This allows them to live in their homes not only independently, but safely, and also out of more costly settings. Thank you so much for letting me testify today.
Thank you so much. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed, followed by Scott House.
Hello, Chair Noor, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Johnson. I'm the policy director at the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, or MCCD. MCCD is likely a new name to many of you, and that's because we are a nonprofit community development membership organization and also a community development financial institution, or CDFI. In addition to small business development, serving primarily BIPOC entrepreneurs and small business owners, we also have an expertise in worker cooperatives and shared ownership businesses. Actually, last year, we were fortunate to work with Chair Noor to introduce a new program at DEED to support shared ownership businesses across many fields. Last year, MCCD was selected by DHS to administer ARPA funds to start up and run home and community-based service cooperative pilot program. 7 months into the project, we have three HCBS cooperatives participating in the program from St. Cloud, Two Harbors, and St. Paul, and we're actively working to recruit more. And actually, if there's anyone in this room interested in learning more, you can seek me out. So MCCD knows that employee-owned cooperatives work, and this specific program is tailored to help address the workforce crisis in the drug care industry by increasing average wages, reducing turnover, and giving those in the industry ownership opportunities. We believe in this program, and while we were hoping for additional funding support from the legislature through House File 2756, we understand that direct appropriations are not always the best answer. However, we do believe that with a few adjustments, we could potentially see this type of work supported through either the HCBS Workforce Initiative Fund or the Workforce Capacity Grants included in the omnibus bill authored by yourself, Chair Noor, or Representative Hicks. I hope I can touch base with you all to discuss these possible changes and how we can support innovative solutions to our drug care crisis in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity today.
Thank you for your testimony. Scott, and then followed by Kathy Messerville, if you can come around, and then Don Simonson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Noor, members of the committee. My name is Scott Kullstrom. I'm the licensed nursing home administrator at a facility called Bayview Nursing and Rehab in Red Wing, Minnesota. I want to start out by echoing the comments of Patty Cullen and let you know firsthand that I am one of those administrators making those calls to our providers and my colleagues. Bayview holds a specific place amongst some nursing homes in the state. We are currently serving 90 residents, many of them the most vulnerable in the state, including ventilator-dependent residents, traumatic brain injuries, and acute, highly complex behavioral and clinical patients. If the facility were to close, approximately 25 to 30 of those residents would most likely be housed in hospitals across the state. And as we all know, those hospital beds are very hard to come by. I am here specifically on behalf of Bayview to ask for reconsideration of HF 2927, which would give Bayview the same consideration that Courage Kinney had already received in 2015. I'm going to leave the rest of my comments to one of my staff members, Charity, who has been with Bayview for more than 10 years.
Thank you, Chairman Noor and other members of the committee. My name is Charity Johnson. I have been a nursing assistant at Bayview for more than 10 years. I am a member of SEIU and act as a union steward at Bayview. We currently have about 100 members working at Bayview. Bayview is very important to our residents. Most of our residents are there because no other facility in the state would take them, whether it's because of their high acute care, behaviors, or just financial reasons. My staff works very diligently to make sure that everybody is taken care of properly, the best that we can. But without any type of financial assistance, it is very, very difficult. And if we were to close, most of our residents would be shipped out of state. So they're going to be further away from their family, their friends. More mental health issues will rise out of this. And not only will our residents be affected by it, but a lot of our staff members will too. A lot of our staff members live right in Red Wing and have no other means of transportation to be able to get to another job or anything else. So the financial assistance for long-term care facilities, whether it's nursing home, group homes, or anything, should be considered a necessity and not an option. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Kathy Messerly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association, a statewide association representing home care agency members who provide hands-on care to older Minnesotans, young children with complex health conditions, and individuals with disabilities in their own homes. While we are still reviewing the many details of the provisions in the bill, I wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you for your investments in home care, for the home health and home care nursing base rate increase, for the homemaker rate changes, and the PCA rate increases. We hope that you will continue to partner with us for the remainder of this session and in the future to address the foundational reimbursement rate challenges that are so significantly impacting access to care. We believe that we need to truly fix the inadequate rate structure in order to address the home care service access barriers that Minnesotans are facing and to ensure that we are making it easier for Minnesotans to access those home care services in place of more expensive and currently overly stressed congregate care settings. From the new mandate to home health providers that they must implement electronic visit verification, to the legislators' current action advancing paid family leave, to facing a simple demographic reality of a shortage of workers, home care providers are navigating numerous complexities in their work to deliver these needed services in the communities around the state. Thank you for your investment proposed in this bill, which is a needed first step forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Don Simonson, and then Kameo Zander, if you can come close by to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Don Simonson. I'm the CEO and president of Trellis, and I'm here today representing the Senior Meals and Services Coalition and the Minnesota Association of Area Agencies on Aging. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of older adults that our organizations and partners serve. Well, we are very grateful for funding for senior meals included as a one-time $4.5 million appropriation in the proposal before us. I ask your consideration to make this appropriation part of the base and to reconsider our full funding request of $10 million. We all know that the population of older adults is increasing exponentially. Currently, more than 1 million older adults reside in Minnesota. We're in the middle of the aging of the baby boom, and the oldest need basic services to remain in their homes and age with dignity. I believe that as a state, we have a collective responsibility to care for low-income, frail, and vulnerable seniors. We cannot let them go hungry and suffer the consequences of malnutrition, serious illness, hospitalization, premature nursing home placement, and death. I want to call your attention to a Mayo Clinic study published in December 22, which found a 28% increase in deaths from malnutrition among women age 85 years of age and older who resided in rural communities in Minnesota in 2020. Mayo's report notes that vulnerability to malnutrition increases with age. I also want to say that elder poverty is real in Minnesota. 1 in 10 older adults in Minnesota live in poverty. Minnesota seniors' visits to food shelves increased 39% in 2021. We must eliminate wait lists in home-delivered meals. We must deliver food to our elderly, vulnerable neighbors. A one-time appropriation will not solve senior hunger. We must do better for everyone in Minnesota and be certain that they have the food that they need to live and thrive. Thank you.
Thank you, Camille Sander, followed by Sue Abdehogan. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Cameo Zender, and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer with Pediatric Home Service. We provide medically complex care to medically complex children in their home, including home care nursing services. I am here today to say thank you for including an approximate 15% rate increase for home care services. Thank you for listening to the stories of our families that are desperate for additional nursing care. Today, receiving only 35 to 50% of the hours that are prescribed by their child's physician. Thank you for hearing the facts that were shared by children's hospitals, physicians, and discharge planners of children remaining in the hospital for months simply waiting for a nurse to take them home and costing the state millions of unnecessary dollars. And for responding to the plea of ICU-level nurses that sacrifice 50% of the wage that they could earn if they practiced their skills in a hospital, but instead are choosing home care. We know that 15% will not close the gap in wage parity, but we still say thank you because this increase will help us to continue shining a brighter light that a meaningful change will make for families and for our remarkable nurses. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota and Co-Chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. And I want to highlight several provisions of the bill. First, the sober homes language is very important to us. About half of people who have a mental illness also have a substance use disorder. NAMI came to the legislature previously with concerns about the quality of sober homes and the need to provide protections for people who are struggling with a substance use disorder and mental illness. We believe there should be a certification process, a bill of rights, and a place to file complaints. I will note that we did a comparison between the National Sober Home Requirements, NAR, which the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes follow, and they are really quite similar. I would add that we want people to be able to file the complaints that they have with the Office of the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and I hope that this amendment is adopted in the future. They are well equipped to carry out this work, and the increased funding in this bill will help. The changes to the SUD system, including the SM levels of care, is viewed as a good step forward in being able to provide better integrated treatment of people with mental illness and substance use disorder. We also support efforts to expand withdrawal management. We believe that it's also important to look at covering traditional healing and behavioral health services in correctional facilities under Medicaid. We strongly support moving DCT, direct care and treatment, to be its own agency, to move it out of DHS. It is an inherent conflict of interest to provide, fund, and license services within one agency. Just two concerns that I want to raise. One is that there was no increased funding for non-emergency medical transportation, and particularly protected transport, which is an alternative to EMTs and police driving people, especially long distances in greater Minnesota. If we had an increased funding, we'd be able to have more protected transport providers. And then I wanted to mention the section on conducting a systematic review of acute care hospitalizations. We agree with the Hospital Association. We should be looking at children and youth in there, but also understanding it's a front door and a back door issue. So we want to make sure that community providers are also part of the people that are consulted as this task force goes forward. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you so much. The next question is Cynthia Gels, if you can come to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Gels. I am self-advocate and employee at ACT, Advocating Change Together. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, for allowing me to testify on behalf of ACT, Advocating Change Together, Center for Disability Leadership. We are concerned and disappointed that the bill does not include funding for the Rick Cardenas Self-Advocacy Grant Program. The Human Service Policy Committee heard my testimony last time, and I want to remind you how much ACT, Advocating Change Together, has helped me to get to where I am in my life today. Yeah, I was one of them people that has and still have a disability, and was always told that I couldn't do this, I couldn't do that, you know. And during the time that I've been with Advocating Change Together, they have really improved my life a great deal. And I feel it would be a big injustice not to include this bill, because there are so many people with disabilities who still don't know they have rights and they can live the way they want. I know the program works. I know the program works because I'm a living product of that program. So the program has really taught me how to my self-esteem and everything. The program teaches us how to do the best so you can be the best. So we urge you to amend the bill to ensure the funding for the Rick Cardenas Self-Advocacy Grant Program is included prior to the House passage. Thank you.
Thank you. The next person is Nikki Villavicencio. If you can come to the table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. My name is Nikki Villavicencio, and I use she, her, sha pronouns. And I live in Maplewood. I'm here as a leader in SEIU Healthcare of Minnesota and Iowa today, and as a union member. We support the DE1 amendment, the House's omnibus human services budget. For over 10 years, disability rights advocates sat and stood beside personal care attendants, fighting for the right to have a union. I was one of those young advocates fighting for the idea that a collective voice for the most marginalized will benefit all. I had the privilege to sit on the first bargaining team, and my vision was then and still is now that if we professionalize the work, we will raise the quality of life for people like me. To start, we do support the 205 of your spreadsheet, which allows personal care attendants to drive clients on paid time. We support the 265 line, which partially funds the governor's long-term care workforce grants. And we endorse the proposal to phase out the subminimum wage, but also wish it was quicker. And the reason why I'm here today, line 195 funds in the SEIU home care contract and related MOUs. Those agreements are ratified in Article 1, Section 47 and 48. The bill invests in $890 million over 4 years to change the lives of home care workers and their clients. Our contract includes a minimum wage increase of $15.25 to $20 over 2 years, a $1,000 retention bonus for those who have worked at least 6 months, a wage scale for experienced workers with stepped-up increases of $22.50 per hour. We also won the ability to shape an orientation program with DHS. This will give caregivers the support and information they need. As someone who has worked on the State Provider Cooperation Committee representing workers and clients since its beginning, the expansion of having an orientation is something we dreamed about 10 years ago. Our contracts have always had strong bipartisan support, which is important to all our members. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and I urge you to support the home care contract so that personal care attendants can support me and the rest of Minnesota.
Next, I have Dr. Camilo and also Mr. Buddy. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My name is Dr. Nathan Chomolo. I'm a board-certified pediatrician and internist, and I serve as the medical director for the Medical Assistance in Minnesota Care Programs at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today to testify in support of the governor's proposal making modifications to the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program. The Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program was established by the state legislature in 2015 to reduce opioid dependency and misuse in Minnesota related to opioid prescriptions, including the establishment of a quality improvement program. DHS is required to undertake these activities under state statute. Since that time, Minnesota has made significant progress in opioid prescribing, but there is still a problem. According to Minnesota Department of Health data, despite the exponential rise in fentanyl overdose deaths, prescription opioids still account for more than 20% of opioid-involved overdose deaths. As the largest payer in the state, DHS has an obligation both to taxpayers and the patients who access their health care via our Minnesota health care programs to ensure the services we pay for uphold evidence-based practice, not just in opioid prescribing, but across all our services and benefits. The Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program was designed specifically to influence the systemic prescribing practices in our state and has been effective in that work. However, direct work with providers over the last 2 years has reinforced the need for the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program as concerning practices in patient care persists in many specialties. The most current prescribing data we have available demonstrates that outliers in prescribing still exist. There are still providers who are unaware of or unwilling to align with clinical practice guidelines. Additionally, feedback from providers, including some of the largest systems in the state, agree that our Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program helps them in their own opioid stewardship efforts. Decisions around opioid prescriptions are complex and must be made in an individualized, patient-centered manner. The governor's budget proposal specifically codifies this value in several places. The Opioid Prescribing Improvement's quality improvement methodology is specifically designed not to dictate how providers should practice, but rather help providers who prescribe opioids to think critically about their prescribing practices. The Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program worked with clinical experts to design an approach to quality improvement that is intentionally tenable for busy clinicians. The quality improvement aspect of OPIP is designed to help prescribers identify places in their processes where they can better align with state and federal clinical practice guidelines. It is a collaborative, non-punitive process. And we do this by having clinical professionals review quality improvement work and even meeting with prescribers who are in quality improvement to discuss how they can incorporate more best practices from clinical guidelines into their day-to-day work. And in 2021, due to the strains of COVID, DHS had very minimal requests of prescribing outliers. And in 2022, at the request of pain providers and other members of the chronic pain community, DHS did not require anything of chronic pain providers in the quality improvement program. We've also been meeting with these providers over the past year to develop a proposal for a waiver from the Quality Improvement Program if certain criteria are met. Currently, DHS has no meaningful authority to act when an opioid prescriber has demonstrated consistently harmful patterns. The opioid prescribing workgroup was made up of some of the foremost clinical experts on opioids in the state and was directed by a legislature to recommend standards to disenroll providers for inappropriate prescribing practices. The OPWG deliberated over this issue over 9 open meetings from February to December of 2021, and they felt a measured approach in this space was critical. Rather than recommending disenrollment standards, they focused on defining prescribing behaviors that were subject to sanctions because they were so extreme that it could result in patient harm or death. In the meetings with the OPWG, the members weighed the importance of ensuring prescribers could make the best decision necessary for their patient, but also balancing the need to ensure patients were not receiving inappropriate care. And the outcome of the OPWG's work is a set of 4 clinical decisions the DHS Office of the Inspector General can apply when investigating Medicaid providers for extreme or egregious practices. At DHS, we envision a future where patients experiencing acute or chronic pain can receive the care they need based on the best evidence available in alignment with state and national guidelines. OPIP is a key strategy to continue moving towards that future. DHS is recommending changes to the current statute in the governor's budget to strengthen and support this approach. We explicitly do not want to tell prescribers what they should prescribe for their patients and are actively trying to codify that value. We also want to ensure this work is informed by clinicians as they are best situated to know the complex realities facing patients and their care team, and that's why the governor's budget requests $136,000 of funding annually to ensure clinicians continue to drive this work. In closing, the recommended changes are patient-centered. They protect patients from excessive opioids and unsafe tapers, and they allow a process for dealing with substandard care as we continue to navigate our way out of the opioid crisis. Thank you, Chair Noor, for carrying the governor's proposal, and we look forward to working with the committee and members throughout the rest of the session on this important issue.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schumann. The last but not the least is Mr. Banning. So, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Burdick, and I serve as Director of State Government Relations for the Department of Human Services. I'm here today on behalf of Commissioner Harpstead, who is in Washington, D.C., meeting with the Federal Administration for Children and Families, and she sends her regrets that she couldn't be with you all today. I want to express our sincere appreciation that your omnibus budget package includes and builds on so many of the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's priorities for DHS programs in the area of human services. Most notably, your focus on long-term care workforce and ensuring that every person in Minnesota who is doing the incredibly impactful and difficult work of providing direct care support earns at least $17 an hour. We appreciate your attention to workers who are the lowest paid in this sector and those who support people with disabilities and older adults in their homes, such as PCAs, including ratifying and funding the SEIU contract agreement and your historic investment in services for older adults. These investments are sorely needed to ensure these critical services are available to Minnesotans who need them. Thank you also for including the governor's budget proposal to honor the work of the subminimum wage task force and phase out the use of this practice to recognize that people with disabilities deserve the same rights and opportunities of all other people across the state. Your investment will help providers, families, counties, and people with disabilities make this transition successfully. Your budget also responds to the urgency of addressing the opioid crisis in Minnesota. As this committee knows fully well, this crisis is only getting worse, with the number of deaths increasing by 44% between 2020 and 2021. Minnesota also continues to have the worst disparities in the nation in terms of opioid overdose deaths. Thank you for recognizing the need to act boldly by funding key recommendations from the governor's budget to continue building our state's continuum of substance use care. We look forward to working with you on the most effective investments that we can make in this area to reverse these trends and to save lives. Last year, the governor and the legislature created a subcabinet focused on opioids, substance use, and addiction, and appointed the director of addiction and recovery to oversee this work. That legislation called to bring forth recommendations for a permanent office, and we appreciate that funding included in this bill. We also really appreciate your support for our direct care and treatment system, the funding of our deficiency request to make up for the overtime and other challenges we've faced during the COVID pandemic and the inflationary crisis that all providers are experiencing, as well as the long overdue creation of an electronic medical record to make sure that we're providing adequate patient care. DCT is a critical part of our human services system and provides a safety net serving folks who other providers are unable to. Thank you also for creation of DCT as a standalone agency. That will position both DHS and DCT to most effectively carry out their missions. Lastly, thank you so much for including so many other of the urgent requests in the governor's budget, and I want to particularly highlight the funding for HIV and AIDS funding that is facing that federal funding cliff that we discussed in committee a few weeks ago. That's going to be a really impactful investment. Thank you for all the work you've done throughout this session and for all of your work to improve the lives of Minnesotans. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Members, do we have any quick technical question? Otherwise, we have...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask what your plans are now for the rest of the week and how we'll be spending our time.
Thank you for the question. So we're planning to, ask for amendments by Wednesday 1 p.m. And then we will have the markup of the bill on Thursday afternoon. And that is the timeline. We have 4 hours of discussion on Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you anticipate the committee meeting for any additional hearings after that?
At this moment, we're not aware, but we will see how things go.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
4 hours.
Any technical questions? No further agenda items. Members, we are now adjourned.